You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our final week discussing Moriarty by Anthony Horowitz. This week is chapters 17 to the end of the book. Full spoilers are in the house. All the twists are unraveled, and Herds has walked away.
I'm feeling good.
Very proud of himself.
I can't say that this was the most complicated mystery to unravel, because after all, in the words of Moriarty and therefore Anthony Horowitz himself, which of the two names appeared on the front cover?
Mysterious.
So I guess we're in full spoilers. Like, Chase was Moriarty all along. That's the big spoiler.
So let's go through what actually happened.
I guess
here.
We should.
We have it revealed to us that the retaliation that Clarence Devereaux makes is that he has taken Athelney Jones's daughter.
Wild.
They go to meet in a graveyard to have her returned, but no, instead they are abducted and taken to the meat tunnels.
It's so silly that they're like, we're going to a graveyard. What a perfect place for a showdown. But actually, we're in a slaughterhouse, which is another perfect place for a showdown. But actually, we're also on the docks, which is another like classic crime location. And it's great. They're all tied together. We narratively like jump from location to location. They're all great and they all make sense. But clearly Horowitz is trying to like cram in as many classic showdown locations as he can before he hits the finish line. And I kind of love it.
I don't know. It's great. And then, of course, we finally have victory. They finally go for Clarence Devereaux, get him in a carriage, being taken to Scotland Yard. The jig is up. The crime is over. London is saved.
Let's be clear here. This victory, in this moment at least, is Athelney Jones's, because he uses a Sherlockian technique of divining where a page, the ransom note for his daughter, the book in which that page has come from, happens to be the library that they're holding the hearing in to see if they can nab Devereaux from the American embassy. It's like his fortress politically. He's got asylum there, essentially. Diplomatic immunity, that's the term. I knew that was a term. But yeah, he does a Sherlockian twist where he goes, there is only one book in the entire library that this page could have come from, nay, in the world, and he produces it, and everyone in the courtroom, and this is called out by the narration in the book, that it's like kind of weird how quickly their opinion changes, but perhaps it's to be expected because they are politicians after all, which is quite a funny little exchange there in Horowitz's kind of commentary. But it leads to Jones's victory directly before heading down the road in an armed escort and being shot in the face by the one person that he kind of neglected to actually properly reason about.
Wait, but who was that?
It was Chase. It was his partner.
It was Chase?
It was his Watson. The entire time was the criminal.
Gets shot in the face by his very own Watson?
I know. I thought it was going to be the back of the head, but the face is more dramatic, I think.
I had a very interesting experience going through that sequence for the first time, because I saw him draw the gun and I was like, you know, that's a little predictable. Like, I'm not sure I quite feel like it stuck the landing here. And then we have this like confession sequence where Moriarty goes through and he announces who he is to the audience and he details why he did all of these things. And we'll get back to that in a second. Then we cut back to him shooting Jones in the face again. And I was like, I don't really feel like that hit for me. I don't feel like it hit. But then I kept reading. And then I went back and, you know, started doing the reread. And I was just honestly so impressed. Like, I think there is a certain type of reader who will read what happens to Frederick Chase and Athelney Jones and feel a sense of heartbreak that friendship did end up being genuine, even if it ended in tragedy. But the initial hit, I think, is structured at a really weird time in the story.
That's an interesting take. I thought it was fine, but maybe that's because I built up this moment so much in my head by the time that I got to it after like thoroughly picking apart all of the Moriarty foreshadowing. I thought it was pretty good because in my mind, it's like a movie. That's how I feel like it's been written. You show the shocking event and then the rest of the episode is explaining that event. And then at the beginning of the next episode of the show, you recap that event, that getting shot in the face, right? Because then you have like what I would call like a spotlight episode, which is just, this is Moriarty's past leading up to this moment, and people debate whether or not that episode could have been cut for time or whatever, because that's how those sorts of things go. But thankfully, this isn't a book. It's all one package. Can't possibly have that debate here. I actually think it's a pretty good sequence for the record, because I always am looking for the scene where the detective finally outs the criminal and the criminal fights back or argues back. Those are always really great scenes. I know we haven't covered Columbo on the show yet, but I've been watching some clips from that show and all of those sequences where there's the one where, when the criminal is like, oh, well, there's another explanation for why your fingerprints would be on this painting. It's because you put them on just now. And then Columbo pulls his hands out and he's got gloves on his hands. He's like, I couldn't have done that. Oh, you got him. Credits roll. But yeah, I like those scenes. So Moriarty's confession scene, the truth of the matter, is that sequence because he is the victor. He gets to explain the crime to us without being like interrupted and hauled away by the detective. And I think that the fact that he feels like conflicted about the killing of his friend, and he explicitly states that he wanted to push Jones off the case after a certain point, once he realized that he had a wife and child, I think that explicitly stating how Moriarty felt throughout the story is kind of a bold move. And I really enjoyed, I guess, just seeing that affirmation, I guess, of how he was really feeling.
I think the thing for me, right, is that the first time through the story, I hadn't realized as much about how this story was about Moriarty's transformation. I think that was the missing piece for me. To some extent, Moriarty has been built up in the broader post-Conan Doyle Sherlock canon as ruthless, bloodthirsty.
And important, most of all, but yeah.
Yes. So this whole sequence of him being like, oh, yes, you know, the gentlemanly sport was over and then I had to shoot this guy in the face was like, oh, yeah, that's pretty typical for you, wasn't it? But then going back over the book again and discussing it with you, it started to sink in for me that, like, that is a reputation that I have brought with me from things that are not the source text. I really enjoyed this idea that we were talking about last week, that this book is about his transformation from gentlemanly gamesman to ruthless, bloodthirsty American vampire, which is why he has to leave London in the end, which is like the final sequence of the book.
And to be super clear, like the killing of Athelney Jones and the symbolic death of Chase, obviously, are the deaths of Moriarty as he was, right? Like we're in a sense, we're seeing the transformation and that rebirth of Moriarty into a character that is no longer contained in Watson's books and is free to go off, free in a sense, to go off and commit horrible murders and beat people up and kidnap their kids and do all the stuff that he does in this book. That punctuation of the gunshot going off twice and of this whole story being about trying to snuff out the last sort of compassionate parts of Moriarty. These are irony, I guess, because Clay was talking about before he was horribly killed, of course, by the goons of the current vampire. He was talking about how Moriarty was always better than Devereaux, but the expectation is that now that we've completed this story, that Moriarty might actually end up being worse than Devereaux now that he's stooped to his level, right? I mean, the way this book ends is they like bundle Devereaux into a coffin because he's a vampire and he needs his coffin. They bundle him into a box and they take him off to America with them so that he can ask Devereaux how he runs his business. So that metaphorical transformation is complete by taking all of Devereaux's assets and his knowledge and eventually his life and taking that into himself and becoming the new Devereaux, even if he doesn't actually take his name, which I thought he might. I thought he might do that, but I don't know that he's going to.
I also did quite enjoy the way that the ending happens quite quickly after the death of Athelney Jones. Like, we don't have the, like, oh, I went and watched over his family. And, like, it's very much, pun intended, cut to the chase. That, you know, Moriarty realizes his time in London is over. This is no longer his world. Like, it's been ruined by Devereaux. So now he's going to ruin Devereaux's.
I do like that the way that's justified in story. Like, obviously, it makes sense in terms of pacing and themes. But, like, in the story, I think it's Moran who says, like, you know, you've been working awfully closely with the British police. And if they didn't know your face before, they sure do now. So you need to leave and never come back. And that's why Moriarty doesn't appear in any of the other Sherlock stories because of this one last great caper that Sherlock and Watson had nothing to do with, so they had no reason to write about him, and they never saw him again because he's played his biggest hand, which was pretending to be a policeman for a while. And I like that a lot. I like that the story neatly inserts itself into Sherlock canon without disturbing anything and having a really good reason why he won't ever come back. Like why he doesn't appear in future books, I guess.
It's such a great example of a continuation story that has a lot to say about its source material, but doesn't mess with what actually happens in the original text. Like there is no, oh, well, this character is so differently interpreted from how they appeared in this other book. Like, I guess you could say that Moriarty does, but we also don't have much to go on there.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, there is Athelney Jones, who is from previous books, but is not a character that has ever mattered. And that is then, that becomes part of his characterization, that he didn't matter until this book.
Well, also, like, we use him as a way to characterize Dr. Watson without having to have Watson ever actually appear in this story, which is so clever.
Yeah, of course. And the Sherlock-Watson relationship, obviously. I do want to say as well that I really enjoyed this ending solidification of both of them, of Moriarty and Jones being characterized as tragic characters, that the ending of this book, even if it was fraught with peril and there were, you know, moments when things could have gone wrong, Moriarty's overarching design and the expertise of his henchmen, Perry and Sebastian Moran, kind of ensured his victory and ensured that things would only end in a tragic way because Moran is only motivated by money and Perry by bloodlust, apparently. And so those two uncomplicated thug characters, which, you know, I love my thug characters, they provide the real mechanisms to get these characters to the end because they do all the grunt work. They plant the bombs and actually leave most of the clues, which, by the way, I didn't think that basically every clue would be planted by Moriarty, but I did really enjoy that. He was like, yeah, the bar is soap. I left it there because soap and you know, barbers and stuff. We'll get more into that later, but I did really enjoy that.
We'll get more into that. Before we wrap this section, though, Herds, I do have one thing that we have to address.
Oh, God, what is it?
And it is either the best or the worst part of this entire book.
Oh, sure. Maths, yeah.
Which is, we have to explain how Moriarty survived Reichenbach Falls. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that Anthony Horowitz chose the perfect explanation considering the themes of this text.
I don't know that I agree with any of this. I
Would you like to explain how Moriarty survived Reichenbach Falls?
The logic follows that because Moriarty is like a bookkeeping organizer, mathematician, science man, that the only way that he could survive falling off of Reichenbach Falls, which may I remind you, in other properties, characters like find a gas mask or they avoid the problem altogether or they just don't explain what happens because they don't care about their audience. In this adaptation, Moriarty survives falling off the Reichenbach Falls by using math to perfectly calculate trajectory into the water. I mean, he's also being knocked in by Sherlock, so like, I don't know how you would be able to perfectly calculate that, but it's bizarre. It's literally just another application of the discombobulate story device.
It's so unreasonably dumb, but at the same time, when the story is talking about how Sherlock is a superhuman character who has abilities beyond the real world, and how Moriarty is now out of place in London and doesn't belong in this reality and has to go to the world of vampires.
Mm-hmm. As you do.
The fact that his superpower is how he escaped somehow just it just clicks on a level I cannot quite put into words. It makes so much sense by being so openly outrageous.
Look, I can follow the train of logic that led Horowitz to the conclusion that this was how it had to be, but the maths superpower of Moriarty it's a bizarre thing to lean on.
I honestly think it may have been one of my favorite lines in the entire book. I put the book down. I walked around the room. I was like, that is absurd. I cannot believe you just got away with that. And I agree with you, Anthony Horowitz.
It's pretty fantastic.
Anyway, we should wrap this part of the discussion here. Come back with the mystery for the end of the show. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. We're discussing Anthony Horowitz, Moriarty. We'll be back with more in just a second. Woo! Flex here. You're listening to Death of the Reader. It's approaching the end of the year here on the show, and presumably that means out there in the real world too. This means, for us, review season, where we rank and reflect on the stories we've read through the course of the year gone by. This year, we would love to feature you on review season, so tell us about what you've enjoyed. Head over to 2ser.com/deathoftheReader with hyphens in between each of the last four words there. That's 2ser.com/death-of-the-reader and follow the contact details there. Tell us about your favorite trends in the crime fiction you've read this year and what your favorite stories are. It'd be fantastic to have some more voices on the show sharing the love of crime fiction as we round out a fantastic year. Hope to hear from you soon. Again, head over to the website, 2ser.com, and find the contact details there. We're going to jump back into Anthony Horowitz's Moriarty. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your murder mystery world tour.
We're doing it. We're still going.
And oh my goodness, Herds.
What's up?
What a book.
Yeah.
You're walking away with 3 points. Cool. I have absolutely no qualms. I wanted to congratulate you on either by precognizance or accident or both correctly getting my bonus point for what the revenge for Blatterston House and, you know, storming the club was going to be.
That was really fun because when the bomb went off, I was like, oh, well, I was wrong then. This is it. I've failed everything. But then what if that wasn't the comeuppance? What if it wasn't? And yeah, I mean, why even have this man's wife and child if you're not going to threaten them callously? Like, what is the point of, I'm pretty sure I said that in the first week. What is the point of having them in the story?
No, you did.
So, very happy.
And for those of you following at home, we are talking Moriarty all the way to the end of the story. And of course, the reason that Herds guessed that correctly is because
I'm a genius.
It is in fact not Clarence Devereaux, the arch criminal of Anthony Horowitz's Moriarty, who blew up Scotland Yard. It was Moriarty himself.
Well, it was Moriarty's henchman Perry, but yeah.
That still counts.
Because he was trying to stop Lestrade's message to the Pinkertons from getting out. To be like, hey, who's this Chase guy? Are they real? And maybe also, is Jonathan Pilgrim one of yours? Which was actually something that if you had asked about, I would not have figured. This is one of the best lines of the book to me. When Devereaux sits down and he's interrogating his witnesses and he's asking all of these questions and saying, you know, there's something fishy going on with you two, Chase and Jones. There's something funny about you two. Who are you working for?
How did you know about this place that was a secret?
And Jones is like, oh, well, it follows logically from all of these things that have happened. And he presents all of the evidence and he's right, but he doesn't consider that the evidence has been manufactured by Moriarty to lead him to the conclusions that he's come to. Ah, it's so good.
Yeah, Moriarty sent Jonathan Pilgrim in, not the Pinkertons.
Yes.
And that mean that they were able to know about a place that hadn't necessarily been leaked to anyone else because, you know, Moriarty still had some underworld connections. There was the Bar of Soap thing where the evidence was planted at Blatterston House because Moriarty was a few steps ahead of what was going on and needed to get Jones there to kind of cover for himself.
Yeah, and Horner 13, the like advertisement for the barbershop was planted. And it's quite funny, actually, because Moriarty keeps saying, you know, I would have produced the clue myself or solved the puzzle for Jones, but Jones kept surprising me with how he would actually solve the puzzle that I intended to solve myself, you know? I think that's actually a really, really fun way of characterizing Moriarty. It's like, he will absolutely hammer the nail on the head, give you the most blatant clues, but he gives Jones enough room to solve the puzzles that Moriarty has created by himself.
Yeah, There's a lot of interesting readings to that as well.
Oh, for sure.
Because Moriarty is always working with mooks who do his work for him. So, like, on the one hand, he's used to working with people who wouldn't be able to solve these things, but there's also this question that maybe he's always been underestimating the people around him.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, that's part of his growth in this story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely do not overestimate Moran and Perry's ability to do anything. Like,
no.
Moran has done nothing but shoot people and throw boulders, and then the last thing he says is, like, I'm going to go hunt tigers in Africa. That seems like a good idea. Like, okay. Yeah,
and you pay me double to be in America, I'll be there, but it better be double.
Yeah, it's like he likes money, he likes to shoot, and he's in bed with Moriarty. Perry is a small runaway child who likes to stab things, you know. You're right. Moriarty's worldview is that when he first entered the criminal underworld, he expected that he'll be terrified of criminals, but he quickly realized that he could manipulate them. And so he was not afraid of them at all. And it's the same with Jones, obviously.
I think one of the really interesting things about the layout of the puzzle in this book is that, as we've mentioned a couple of times, there are so many little bite-sized puzzles that don't initially feel like they're all going to add up to terribly much.
Well, a lot of those puzzles are presented by Moriarty, right?
Exactly.
They're curated by him in order to lead to something specific that he wants Jones to find or for us to find.
Yeah, I would say about the first half of the book, it feels like a lot of the little puzzles that you get are set up and then pay off very quickly, so you as a reader don't really get too much of a chance to, like, jump ahead of them and think about what's going on. But as the story gets deeper in, you start to realize how these little puzzles all kind of heap grains of sand onto this big old pile of dirt. It's such an interesting puzzle structure because it threw me off when I was first going through the book.
Sure.
I didn't think that it would be very conducive to the show initially because all of the puzzles are solved for you within about a chapter of them appearing. But then, of course, because they've been solved, that's then an opportunity for Anthony Horowitz to mislead you into thinking that you don't have to worry about them anymore.
That there's no puzzle when there is one. And in fact, I would say that the fact that the puzzles are so simple and are solved so quickly is also kind of a clue as to how quickly they've been put together in the first place.
Yes.
Which is indicative of Moriarty basically creating the mystery. You know, he's laying the train tracks in front of the train that Jones is on, barreling towards the edge of a cliff. And Moriarty's just trying to get him there. This is one of those books in a long tradition of books that have the surface puzzle or surface puzzles, and they all lead to one much deeper twist that is fundamental to the characters and is the part of the story that people are actually going to talk about, right? Like, the characterization of Moriarty is more interesting than analyzing any individual puzzle in the book.
I think it's something that's so fascinating about this text in general is that there's so much about this that, like, the first time through, the first glance at, the first half of, that I wasn't particularly sold. But seeing the whole thing in hindsight as one cohesive picture, I'm like, damn, that was clever.
Yeah.
This was awesome. That was awesome. I was so impressed by this. Like, this has been one of my favorite books of the year. Handily top of the pack for me.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I mean, there's just a lot of scenes as well that are just fun to read. And not just in a murder mystery sense, but in a, like, wow, these characters are in danger. They're in trouble. What are they going to do? Uh-oh, Perry's come out of the bush. He's going to stab Chase, who is definitely, you know, because that's something that he mentions. He says, oh, maybe there's a third party in here somewhere, says Chase, as though he's part of the second party and not the third party. And mm-hmm. So that plants that idea of what if Perry just stabs everybody? What if they're all caught up in this net? The individual scenes are just fun to read because there's a lot of action and character drama and interrogation by people's wives, who are secretly the smartest character in the book.
As always.
There's a lot of tropes in here as well. Like, that in itself is a very classic, like, crime trope. But I think that the usage of tropes and the subversion of the things that we're expecting from specifically a Sherlock story all works to create something that is exciting and still interesting to talk about. So that's nice.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, even though we're viewing it through the modern murder mystery context, to some extent, Anthony Horowitz is very much going for the fancy twist that ties everything together style of some of the original Arthur Conan Doyle stories. And, you know, not all of them are the most impressive. Because I'm still feeling bitter about the Sign of the Four, if I'm to be perfectly honest.
Really? Interesting. I feel great about it. I know what you're talking about.
just this way that he's blended the like modern interpretation and classic interpretation of the texts is so wonderful. Like, you know, Jared Harris plays Moriarty in the Guy Ritchie and Robert Downey Jr. adaptation. And I was picturing a Jared Harris playing Frederick Chase this entire time through without necessarily like seeing it in this huge out of scale sense that those films got. Like, it's not as unhinged as the BBC version, but we still very much have that, like, sense of danger as we build this character into something slightly different. It's just, it's so appreciative of its source material in a way that comes across really well as a reader.
Yeah. I think also that it respects the reader is definitely, like, a huge part of that. I think it's quite funny that chapter 21, the confession section, starts with Moriarty telling the reader that I don't care about you, reader, but I think that the fact that the reader can put themselves in the shoes of either Moriarty or Jones throughout this story, and it's all relatable. The narration doesn't explicitly lie to you, you know, that sort of trope. It just leads to a good relationship between the reader and the book. Although I am aware of accusations that, you know, understanding the twist before it happens can feel a little unsatisfying, but
yeah, I mean, I feel like that is a very common trope for readers to say without much faith in the author.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is a whole other conversation to have, which we should probably do at some point. But like, I feel like you kind of have to trust that if you think that the mystery is too easy, then there's either more to the mystery or you're kind of supposed to have figured it out by now. Like in that confession sequence, Moriarty even says, I trust by now, dear reader, you have figured out who I am. Like you're kind of supposed to have figured out, I think definitely after the Devereaux sequence, when he's interrogating the two of them,
yeah,
he's like,
they basically there's a mystery. Hand it to you there.
Yeah. He's like, I don't know what's going on. And the police don't know what's going on. There's a third party. Who could it possibly be? Closes book and looks at cover. Who could the third party be?
I wonder when Moriarty will show up in Anthony Horowitz's Moriarty.
Who could be the third party to
really
play
weird
the world's
of him to name
smallest
a book
violin?
After a dead guy.
Yeah, like who could play the world's smallest violin at this tragedy that's occurring between these characters?
I think the other interesting one that you see a lot, we did touch on it last week, is that like Anthony Horowitz does tend to write more somber, gruesome crime fiction than a lot of the people that he is riffing on or contemporary to, at least in the sense that like they're often sadder than other modern, more mystery oriented fiction.
I mean, I remember when we read Magpie Murders.
Yes.
Yes.
Very, very good job dropping the...
I'm not having the... I could appreciate, you know, the wit in that book, but I think, looking back on it, I didn't enjoy how cruel he was to some of his characters. And that's something that I'm going to bounce off of. But I think that by picking Moriarty and these characters that we already know, there's a sense of distance there. And I can kind of appreciate the cruelty and the tragedy in a little bit more of a Romeo and Juliet sort of way. Like, I already know what's going to happen.
I probably am personally going to go back to Magpie Murders because I definitely felt that, like, just chronologically in our lives, that book was handed a very, very unfortunate time to be read. And
maybe, yeah.
I think kind of seeing it through the lens of this book now, I'm like, oh, that's actually really clever. And like, that's been my huge takeaway from this book is that every time I sit and think about it for a little bit longer, I'm slightly more impressed by the themes, by the puzzles, by the structure, by the pacing. It's made me excited to read more. And that is the sign of a good book, if I had to boil it down to a single observation.
I should say, by the way, that I know I said Romeo and Juliet, but I'm actually going to quote Hadestown, the musical.
Good musical.
Based on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. I think that that is a much better encapsulation of what I'm talking about. A big theme in that musical is that you're seeing the same story played out night after night, and it always has the same ending.
Is that our next murder mystery?
It's not. Hadestown? We're not doing Hadestown. No. I should tell you what we're doing, though. So now that we're done with Moriarty by Anthony Horowitz, a Sherlockian continuation story with no Sherlock, we are going to be covering Hercule Poirot's Silent Night, which is the latest in a series of Poirot continuation novels by Sophie Hannah.
Yes.
It is a Christmas-themed murder mystery.
Woo!
I'm super ready for it.
I'm very excited for that.
Yeah. So look forward to that next week on the show. It's going to be wild.
This is your Murder Mystery World Tour. We will be back with Sophie Hannah's Silent Night. You're listening to Death of the Reader here on 2SER 107.3. Catch you then. We're out of here.